Shadows, a Clark Ashton Smith podcast.
Among the many gargoyles that frowned or leered from the roof of the new-built Cathedral of Vionne, two were preeminent above the rest by virtue of their fine workmanship and their supreme grotesquerie. These two had been wrought by the stone carver Blaise Reynard, a native of Vionne, who had lately returned from a long sojourn in the cities of Provence, and had secured employment on the cathedral when the 3 years' task of its construction and ornamentation was well nigh completed. In view of the wonderful artistry shown by Reynard, it was regretted by Ambrosius, the Archbishop, that it had not been possible to commit the execution of all the gargoyles to this delicate and accomplished workman. But other people, with less liberal taste than Ambrosius, were heard to express a different opinion.
Bonjour, bienvenue mes amis. Welcome to Season 3, Episode 3 of Strange Shadows, the Clark Ashton Smith podcast. The voice you just heard was Shelley de Cruz of Graveheart Designs, reading the opening paragraph of today's story. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Poyton.
And I'm the other one, Tim Mendes. Yeah, and I'm currently blown away by your parlez-vous en français there, sir.
The old O-level French has never left me, you see.
I didn't do it. I did German, so I'm useless.
Well, I thought it was appropriate as we are returning to Averoigne once more.
Indeed, yeah. It was interesting to have two Averoigne stories back to back.
It was, and I did wonder if there was going to be a connection between the two. Mm. But when I looked at the dates and the names, even though one name seemed quite familiar, they're actually about 40 years apart. Well, this one is set in 1138, and last time the Holiness of Azedarec was 1175, I think.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit later. And interestingly enough, this is the earliest set Averoigne story.
Ah.
Obviously, it's not the earliest that are written because we're covering these in chronological order.
Indeed.
But this is the earliest set in 1138.
Which was the earliest one? A Knight in Malnion? Was that the first one? I think it was, wasn't it?
I think it was, isn't it? Back in, was that season one, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
Yeah. And well, again, what a evocative story that was, wasn't it?
Indeed. Yeah, really good.
So we're not actually in the forest this time. We are in the city of Vionne, which was mentioned in the previous story. And this tale revolves around a character known as the Maker of Gargoyles.
Interestingly, it was originally called the Carver of Gargoyles.
Ah,
yeah.
The Carver and the Maker. I wonder why that was changed.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I can't find any reference to why he changed the name of it, but the early draft was called the Carver.
Yeah, I mean, the Maker does imply, well, carving implies you take something and you craft it, right? You physically cut. Maker implies a sort of act of creation, doesn't it? Perhaps a bit more, which, as we see, is in effect what he does, though the mechanism by which that happens is never really explained.
No, it's not, is it? No.
So I'm going to take a wild guess on this and say that as good as this story is, it had a troubled publication history. Would I be right in guessing that?
Oh, you'd be more than right guessing that. Yeah, after last time when it got snapped up instantly, we're back into familiar territory here. It was completed on June the 16th, 1931, and he subbed it to Strange Tales. At the same time, he sent it to the other members of the circle, where it was noted that it had a very similar theme to an idea in H.P. Lovecraft's Commonplace book. Now, I believe you've ferreted out a letter, haven't you?
Yes. So I'm just going to read a quick extract from that letter. Well, part of the reason I wanted to read this was not only because of the comment, but also, of course, because of the return address. So once again, buckle up. Here we go.
Nice.
So this is from Smith to Lovecraft, mid-August 1931. The return address is given as the vaults of Jovombis on Mars at the opening of the Nether Crypt and the release of the diabolic giant leeches.
Diabolical giant leeches. That's amazing.
Isn't that great? Isn't that great? That's, that should be on a menu in a fancy sort of restaurant. I'll have the diabolic giant leeches, please. And Smith wrote, I was pleased to hear that my new Averon tales proved acceptable. I hope you won't let any coincidence of idea in the gargoyle yarn prevent you from developing your own tale. Your treatment, I imagine, would be quite different from mine, and certainly there is plenty of room. I've never seen a story at all similar to The Maker of Gargoyles, but the notion is one that might readily occur to imaginative minds. And there is some speculation as well that this is the first ever story that had a gargoyle come into life.
Oh, really?
Which, given how far back gargoyles go, is quite an interesting thing, isn't it? I don't know if that's true or not. Yeah.
That is. Yeah. Well, that's interesting speculation, that. Something, I don't know how you'd look it up, but we'd quite like to know that. If any of our listeners know of any stories before this that involved living gargoyles, do let us know, because I'm genuinely intrigued by that idea.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, August Derleth, he liked the story immensely, but he had some suggestions because the ending was originally quite different. He says, I found one thing about which I might make a suggestion, the end. I think it's pretty evident what's causing all the trouble since you play up the gargoyles so that the climax being the Maker's realization seems weak to the reader. Why not have him go up and destroy the gargoyles, and in their destruction, himself be killed? Say he goes up to the roof, there's a moment of cataclysmic realization, then in sudden repentant horror, he seizes something and begins to demolish them, tumbling then from a roof. Suddenly he feels something pulling at him, he loses hold and plunges downwards. In the morning, he is found crushed on the cathedral steps, his clothes still caught firmly in a claw of one of the gargoyles. Now, yeah, Smith wrote back to Derleth that he thought your suggestions about Maker of Gargoyles is damn good, and I shall adopt it if the tale comes back from Harry Bates, who is evidently holding it for the publisher's reaction. Adding, funny, I seem to have more trouble with the endings of stories than anything else. God knows how many I've had to rewrite. So that's interesting, isn't it? That the ending basically is Derleth's.
Yeah, that is. And also, it's nice to know that even Smith had trouble with endings, because I think that's a common thing across most authors and writers.
Oh, yeah. Stephen King.
The starting is fine. Sometimes it's the ending.
It's sticking the landing, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, especially in a weird tale where it's not like a whodunit where you kind of wrap everything up.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no denouement. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
But so evidently Bates rejected it. And so he did the revisions, and then he subbed it to Weird Tales, where he was rejected.
Farnsworth.
Smith wrote to Derleth again. Unfortunately, and somewhat to my disgust, Wright returned Gargoyles as melodramatic and unconvincing. So, yeah, he resubbed the revised version back to Bates. It was again rejected. So at this point, Smith basically sat on it for a while. He shelved it for a few months before digging it out and rewriting a couple of paragraphs. The paragraphs at the end with the fight and things like that, he rewrote them to make them a bit more action.
Oh, right.
And then subbed it back to Farnsworth Wright, who accepted it this time. And this time it was accepted and published in the August 1932 issue. And Smith was paid $56 for the story.
Okay. Not a bad payout then.
No.
Though obviously you had to wait quite some time for that. So
that's the problem, isn't it? Yeah.
I have to say again with Farnsworth, I know it does sound like we pick on him a bit, and, you know, sometimes with good reason. Melodramatic. Mm. It's a pair of gargoyles coming to life and slaughtering people.
Pretty much.
What do you want to tone the drama down a bit? I mean, I don't really understand.
Yeah, I don't get it. I really don't understand it.
Okay, so let's get into our favourite words, shall we? I found actually for an Averoigne story, there weren't so many in this as last time.
No.
The language is as good, but I don't think it's quite as baroque as Ederach.
Now, it's interesting you mention that, because it's something I've written down here, because I made an observation. I made exactly the same observation. In fact, I put down here, less florid.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I've noticed this, looking at Smith's stories in the way we have, that the ones that have had a lot of revisions tend to have toned-down language.
Ah, right.
Whereas Ederach was instantly taken. There was no revisions.
Right.
So that was Smith's original vision. I wonder how much he was toning it down for these publishers who say it's too melodramatic.
Yeah.
So I'll take out some of the more baroque language.
Yeah, it's an interesting speculation, isn't it?
And
it must have been frustrating to write something that had such great imagery and potent language as Ederach.
Yeah.
And then your next one, if he had done the same thing, and they say, no, it's too melodramatic. But it wasn't melodramatic last time. It must have been tearing his hair out. There's no rhyme or reason to this, is there?
No, none at all. I mean, the thing is, because I've done it, when a story has been rejected a couple of times, I've toned it down because it's come back. It's too purple, you know. Because, right. I mean, like... not my modern set stuff, but my stuff that's set in Victoria, I tend to go with more of that kind of language because it just feels right to me that it should.
Well, it fits.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You want to go for lots of, you know, lots of descriptions of gaslights and stuff, because that's Victoriana, right? But I've had it come back to me. Oh, there's too much descriptive passages, too much, you know, florid language. It's
too many notes.
Yeah, too many notes.
I always love that quote. I don't know if that was true or not, Mozart's quote. Well, which ones should I take out then, Your Majesty? Anyway, I do have some words. There were actually a couple here that I had to look up, but my opening one is a word which I know the meaning of, but I just like the sound of it. Grotesquerie.
Oh, yeah. That's a great one, isn't it? Now, the first one I went with was Aspergillus. Aspergillus, which is a fungi, it's a type of mold, and it's also a disease that parrots cause.
But it's also the name given to that little sprinkler they use in Catholic Mass.
Yeah, strange. Yeah.
So is that because it's mushroom shaped? Do you think, is that where the connection is?
I think it must be, because it is that type of fungi. It is the similar sort of shape, that's what it is in this context, because they're on about holy water and aspergillus. So it's that salt shaker that they do, you know.
I can beat you at dominoes.
Yeah, that job. But it's comes from a type of fungi. Yeah, so there we go.
Which is quite Averroine-ish.
Indeed.
Averroine-y?
Averroine-y?
We just make words up here, we don't care.
Yeah.
My second choice is one of those words that I'm never quite sure if I knew the meaning or not, egregiously or egregious. I think ever since seeing, was it The League of Gentlemen? Yeah. I don't even remember that, that particular episode. And I was never quite sure what it's meant, and I had to look it up again. And it's something that's obviously wrong, in fact, flagrantly wrong, deliberately wrong or bad.
One of the ones I picked, again, is one I know, and in fact, it's one I've actually used as a story title, but I just love it. It's Peregrinations.
Oh, yes, yeah. Marvellous.
Yeah, I had a story in a cult detective magazine last year called The Perilous Peregrination.
Oh, so, alliteration as well.
Oh, yeah. It was a Eugene Angove story, so, you know, I kind of go with alliterative titles for them. So...
I like this one as well. I guess this is one of Smith's older words, probably out of use, potations.
Nice.
Which is simply booze, basically.
Indeed. I thought that when I was doing it, so I should use that. Yeah. I'm off down the local hostelry for a number of potations.
Yeah, because libation is the other one like that.
I use that one a lot. Yeah.
And the other one I always like, it was the guy on Coronation Street used to say it. Savident, was it? Charles Savident? Fred Savident? Tincture.
Can I
interest you in a tincture?
Nice. Yeah. Another one I went with is one we've actually had before, but it's so nice we'll have it twice, is Catafalque, which is the raised beer that supports a coffin. I just love it.
Yeah. And my last one, which I kind of guessed because the sound of the word was familiar to me, but there's a nice little backstory to this, and I'm not sure how this is pronounced, but it's Strygge. So I'm guessing Strygge, which I thought straight away, Strygge, which is witch I can't remember if it was Latin or Greek. So Strygge was witch. But we also have Strix, which is owl. And owls were believed in ancient times to be bloodsuckers. Now, how does this relate to gargoyles? Well, one of the main gargoyles on Notre Dame in Paris is called Le Strygge, or the vampire, or the spitting gargoyle.
Nice.
So, it's not technically a gargoyle. We'll get into this a bit later on. What is a gargoyle and what is a grotesque?
Yeah.
We can talk about that. But this was when Notre Dame was restored in the 19th century by Violette Le Duc. He carved this Le Strygge, which sits there. We'll link to the photo. It's got quite a contemplative air about it. It's got like its chin in its hands, and it's on the North Tower of Notre Dame looking out over the city below. So it's quite a thoughtful looking creature. Not particularly threatening, but interesting. And of course, in The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Hugo included this. I think he becomes friends with the Hunchback. I think the Hunchback goes up and has little chats with him. And we're very pleased to say, very pleased to learn that Le Strygge survived the 2019 fire of Notre Dame. So
excellent.
It's still there, brooding over Paris.
Yeah, all this talk of gargoyles just made me remember something. My favourite gargoyle is on Paisley Abbey. Up in Scotland, it's a xenomorph.
Oh, yes, I remember seeing that now. Oh, yeah, that's brilliant, isn't it? Yeah.
I just started to look it up. It just popped in my head. It was like, oh, where's that xenomorph?
Well, let's talk about that now then, the gargoyles, grotesque things, because the basic difference is a gargoyle is a water spout, a decorative water spout.
Yeah.
And, well, the origin of the name is believed to be gargou again. See, I started off strong with the French pronunciation. Now it's all downhill. Gargouille.
You sound like somebody from Hello, Hello.
I will say this only once.
Yeah, exactly.
Gargouille, which refers to the throat. And I always had that notion as well, I don't know if it's apocryphal, that the name came from, that's where gargle comes from.
Mm.
Because it's garg and de l'eau, the water, so throat and water. I don't know how true that is. But, so basically the gargoyle is a decorative water spout, and we think of the stereotypical gargoyle as the wings and the fangs, but actually there's quite a lot of different forms.
Yes.
And that's why I think the xenomorph fits in, because it's got the extended jaw, mouth, fangs, whatever it is, which provides the spout.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so a lot of gargoyles are like dragon, long necks like a dragon or something like that.
Yeah, lindworms and all that kind of stuff, isn't it? Your winged serpents and all that kind of stuff.
And quite a few of them are monks as well, and some of them are doing quite rude and naughty things, aren't they?
Indeed they are, aren't they just? Yeah.
They're believed to, the legend goes that the Bishop of Rouen in the 7th century subdued a bat-winged dragon-like creature called La Gargoyle or Goji. So he subdued this by use of a crucifix and holy words. It was dragged back to the city and burned. but the head and neck didn't burn. They survived the flames. So they were mounted on the local church as a kind of protection against evil spirits. And this is something that it caused some controversy in the Catholic Church, apparently, and St. Bernard of Clairvaux in particular was very against this sort of stuff, because the gargoyle was basically what they call apotropaic magic, protective magic, which, you know, it's a little bit kind of, we're going to put a big scary monster on. Yeah, I don't remember seeing that in, you know, the New Testament.
It's a little bit pagan, isn't it? Yeah, just a little bit. But that's the thing with, like, the like Christmas trees, the fact that it was adopted by Christian traditions is very strange to me, because that's sympathetic magic. That was an act of sympathetic magic. You brought the tree inside to protect it.
Yeah. And in a way, you revere it, you decorate it, right? And you adorn it with shiny things and all that.
Yeah. It's always struck me as incongruous. Yeah.
So there we are. Technically speaking, a gargoyle is a waterspout. And if it isn't a waterspout, if it's just a carving, it's a grotesque. But what we have here in the story, in Vion, it's definitely a pair of gargoyles.
Very, very, very badly behaved gargoyles, yeah. Especially one of them. Yes, well.
It wouldn't be Smith if we didn't have a bit of Lusty Pan thrown in for good measure.
Lascivious, I think he calls it at one point. It's just like, yeah, that's one word for it, mate. Yeah.
I think lubricious pops up again, doesn't it, in this?
Yeah, I think it does, yeah.
So we have the cathedral at Vion, quite a new cathedral. And one of the people working on this is Blaise Renard. Now, straight away, you think of Renard the Fox, right?
Yeah.
Which I didn't realise was actually a medieval set of fables. I didn't realise it went back that far. And there are several versions of this in medieval France and England, in Germany, of this sort of trickster-like character.
Yeah, I didn't realise it went back that far.
And this is where I got slightly confused with the names at first, because here we have the Archbishop Ambrosius, who commissions Reynard to carve these gargoyles. And I was thinking, hang on, wasn't he in the last story? But of course, that brother Ambrose, right?
Ambrose, that got me as well. No, that tripped me up to begin with. Yeah.
That's why I was wondering, is there any connection? I mean, I suppose we can still speculate that given the time frame, this could be a father or grandfather or something like that. There could be a...
Oh, yeah, very possibly. I like the fact that Ambrosius is described as having very liberal tastes for an archbishop. And considering one of the gargoyles, yeah, again, that's one word for it.
Yes. And not everyone shares his taste, do they? In fact, there seems to be quite a personal dislike towards Reynard in Vion, even from his boyhood.
Indeed.
And he's been away for a while for unspecified reasons, and he's returned. And we get this description of his appearance. Whether rightly or unjustly, his very physiognomy had always marked him out for public disfavour. He was inordinately dark, with hair and beard of a preternatural bluish black, and slanting ill-matched eyes that gave him a sinister and cunning air. His taciturn and saturnine ways were such as superstitious people would identify with necromantic knowledge or complicity, and there were those who covertly accused him of being in league with Satan. So it's very much that old school thing of how someone looks is a reflection of their soul, isn't it, I guess, or their morality.
Yeah. Well, you got to remember that things like phrenology were a big thing back then, you know. Bumps on people's head could, you know, a stray lump here and there could mean they're a murderer kind of thing, you know. Yeah. Well, utter cobblers, but there was a whole science behind it. But I just like the fact that he pretty much described Vincent Price.
Nice. I didn't get that. I was I was trying to think what I did get from it. Oh, it's like a character from one of those old silent black and white. It's like a Rasputin or something like that. Or maybe it was a Jekyll and Hyde film. I can't remember. Was it Barrymore? Was an early sort of Jekyll and Hyde, I think, wasn't it? Yeah. Or Jekyll, I should say. Pronounce it properly. Jekyll. Yeah. Yeah, that kind of silent movie villain type I was getting.
Yeah, the other one I got was the original Master, played by Roger Delgado.
Oh, yes.
In the 70s. Yeah.
He was saturnine with a capital S, wasn't he? That guy?
Oh, wasn't he just? Yeah. He didn't so much talk as purr. Yeah.
So, yeah, the appearance of these two gargoyles just really, in their minds, confirms these people's suspicions about Reynard, because they sound very striking. We get a description of each one. Perched on opposite corners of a high tower of the cathedral, one was a snarling, murderous, cat-headed monster with retracted lips revealing formidable fangs and eyes that glared intolerable hatred from beneath ferine brows. This creature had the claws and wings of a griffin and seemed as if it were poised in readiness to swoop down on the Citavion like a harpy on its prey. So very predatory, carnivorous.
Indeed. Predator with a capital P, absolutely. I like the comparison to a harpy, because again, they're with the wings and all the rest of it, the griffin wings kind of thing. It's like your very traditional harpy. I liked that comparison. I thought that was quite interesting.
And the second one is no less monstrous, but slightly different in tone. Shall I have it?
Just a little bit. Yeah. He's the Rumpy Pumpy Gargoyle. Its companion was a horned satyr with the vans of some great bat, such as might roam the nether caverns with sharp, clenching talons and a look of satanically brooding lust, as if it were gloating above the helpless object of its unclean desire.
Like you said, lascivious.
Lascivious, yes, indeed. Yeah.
And I thought there's a little Smith implication here, of which there's a couple in this. Both figures were complete.
Indeed.
Even to the hindquarters, and were not mere conventional adjuncts of the roof. So, yeah, your normal gargoyle, it sort of comes out of the stone, doesn't it? To, you know, it's a spout.
Yeah.
These are actually fully formed figures.
Yeah. I've got images of where the spout could have gone on the Rumpy Gargoyle. Yeah.
That's like, was it the Pissoir? And it was, yes, what's the what's the statue? Is it in Belgium? Is it that statue?
I know exactly what you're talking about, but I can't.
I'm sure one of our listeners will remind us of the name of that.
Yeah.
And the imagery in this one, we had a certain amount of satanic imagery in Azedarak, but it was underpinned with that deeper mythos lore. Here, it's all pretty much straight satanic. There's quite a lot of mention of the S word.
Yeah.
And also things like Belial is mentioned and various other demons later on.
It's very much from the Christian perspective, because you got lots of talk of blasphemy and all this. It is all very much from that sort of point of view, isn't it? From that perspective.
Yeah. And everyone understands that a certain amount of grotesquerie was requisite in gargoyles. But in this case, the allowable bounds had been egregiously overpassed. That lovely phrasing again from Smith.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. But despite all these criticisms, when the cathedral's completed, the gargoyles, like other details of the building, were soon taken for granted through mere everyday familiarity, and eventually they were almost forgotten. Isn't that just so true about life? You'll get like a complete uproar about something when it's being built. A year later, nobody bats an eyelid about it.
Oh, totally. And I mean, even more so today with the news being a story.
It's all off Twitter.
Two or 3 days and then it's gone, isn't it? It's,
yeah.
But also like this, like you say, all the fuss dies down. No one even really looks at it anymore. But Reynard can't help sneaking a look at them every now and again with secret satisfaction, whose cause he could hardly have assigned or delimited.
Mm.
And Then we get this. They seem to retain for him a rare and mystical meaning to signalize an obscure but pleasurable triumph. And it's this idea that within these stone creatures, it somehow is transferred into them, both is hatred of the townspeople, who he seems to despise, but also his lustful thoughts towards one Nicolette Villon, who's a taverner's daughter. And she's the reason he's hanging around in Villon as well, because he's obviously trying to woo her, but she doesn't seem to be particularly interested.
No. In fact, she seems much more interested in pretty much everybody else.
Yeah, so we've got these two big resentments building up in him. We've got this hatred towards the... perhaps he sees them as superstitious, backwards types, maybe. It's not really specified.
Yeah.
But also this burning lust, this unrequited... Well, you might call it love in some form, I suppose. Certainly a passion. And we learn, really, it's that passion that have brought him back to the detested city of his youth after years of wandering. So this is a driving passion as well. This is not just a crush he's got. He's actually come back for her.
Which is a common theme in Smith, isn't it? Of that trying to recapture a lost or unrequited love. And it never works out how you expect or how they'd like it to work out. You know, and this is no exception. You know?
Very true. And I really like how this first chapter closes. So summer draws to an end and the autumn rains gather upon Villon. Then, when the four cathedral gutters poured above the streets, one might have thought that the actual spittle of a foul malevolence, the very slaver of an impure lust, had somehow been mingled with the water that ran in rills from the mouths of the gargoyles. Beautiful.
That's it. Beautiful passage, isn't it?
And that gets us into chapter two, where we get a little bit of background about Averon and the city or the town.
Yeah, I really liked this because it's on two sides, the great shadow haunted forest, a place of equivocal legend, of loops, gurus and phantoms, approached to the very walls and flung its umbrage upon them at early forenoon and evening. Which is a really nice callback to the previous story and obviously Night in Malnion and various other Averoian stories. Most of them are set in the forest. And it is always described as a very brooding and dark and full of beasties kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that I thought that was a really nice sort of callback to them earlier stories.
It ties the two together nicely, doesn't it?
It does.
And you get this impression of Villon seems, well, it's described here as a prosperous place. It's well thought of, sanctified by the presence of two nunneries and a monastery, and now the cathedral as well. Yeah, it sits in the shadow of this brooding, haunted forest. It's typical Smith again. We've got this very nice... In this case, an urban setting, medieval urban setting. We can imagine the market going on and chickens running around, and kids with hoops and all that sort of stuff. Yet just outside, the forest lurks.
Yeah, definitely. It also reminds me of those, you know, when you're on like a long drive or something, and like growing up, going along the Pennines, across like Saddleworth Moor and stuff like that, and it's all bleak. And a bit foreboding, and you're like, God, if I break down here, I'm knackered. And then you see like a cluster of lights in the distance, you know, civilization and getting closer kind of thing. And that's kind of how I see this. But obviously the forest and that, it's that.
And then you find yourself in Royston Vasey.
Indeed, yeah. Or worse, Macclesfield.
I couldn't possibly comment. I was in Macclesfield once, but I was only there for an hour or two. I can't even remember why now. I probably blotted it out of my mind. But
you got out alive. That's all you need to know. Well, you got out alive and unmolested. That's the best you can hope for.
As far as I can remember, I mean, who knows? And we get this nice mention of the devil again, the old adversary, and saying, of course, in all medieval towns at that time, you've got occasional instances of alleged sorcery or possession, and once or twice the perilous temptations of succubi. But that's just what was expected at the time, because the devil and his works were always more or less rampant.
Yeah. Yeah, this is definitely one of Smith's hornier tales, isn't it? There's a lot of mention of various, you know, yeah, lascivious again. Yeah.
Priapic. So that's all par for the course, that kind of thing. But what happens now in the autumn of that year goes way beyond anything that's ever happened before. We're into real horror territory now. And it starts with two men, a respectable clothier named Guillaume Maspierre and an equally reputable cooper, one Jerome Mazal, heading back to their lodgings at one November Eve after, well, they've been out on the piss, basically.
They had, yeah, imbibing both the red and white wines of the countryside. So, yeah, doing both barrels there, bless them.
And you might think the sort of event that occurs, again, I'm thinking of those old black and white films. One guy gets attacked by something, the other guy goes off screaming, and they're just going to say, oh, you're drunk. It doesn't quite work out like that, but that's where I thought this was going to go.
Yeah, I love this description here. They skirted the cathedral square and could see the bulk of the great building against the stars when a flying monster, black as the soot of Abaddon, had descended upon them from the heavens and assailed Jerome Mazal, beating him down with its heavily flapping wings and seizing him with its inch-long teeth and talons. It's a great image, isn't it? Just plucking him.
It is. I mean, it is a classic gargoyle demon-like figure, isn't it? It really is. And it gets quite graphic, this one as well, I think.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Smith really, I wouldn't say he was a gory writer, not in the vein, if you pardon the pun, of a Robert E. Howard, who is very graphic. But nonetheless, he doesn't detract from it. Whereas I feel Lovecraft always pulled back from that a little bit.
He did. Yeah, I think Smith is like the bridge between the two. Mm. I think Long falls more into the category of, and certainly Block did, into the category of like Robert E. Howard. There was quite a lot of bodily fluids and severed limbs in their stuff.
Yeah.
But Lovecraft, and I thought Smith was more kind of subtle about it. Is it? Can you even call like death like a poetic deaths in stories? I don't know.
I suppose in a sense it was more like the films of the day, you know, where you wouldn't actually, you might see a little bit of blood perhaps, but people would be run through or there'd be sword fights. It certainly wouldn't be like a modern film where everything is, you know, shown sometimes in slow motion, you know.
Yeah, slow motion, a limb flying through the air.
So, I feel he was of his time in that respect, I think.
Mm.
I think Howard was beyond that, really. Howard was more like a modern writer in his levels of gore.
Yeah. Yeah, Robert Block certainly was.
Right. Yeah. In fact, when you think, I'm trying to, this is a wide net to cast, but mythos stories in general, I can't think that they're overly gore filled. You can think of certain scenes or instances across the spectrum, if you like, but gore is not the primary horror, is it? I guess that's why.
No, I mean, there are exceptions to that, but yeah, no, I think on the whole, because it is more about suggestion, isn't it?
Mm.
And letting the reader's mind fill in the blanks to a degree. That's one of the great things about weird tales, like what we often talk about, leaving the end ambiguous.
Yeah.
It's the same sort of thing, isn't it? Because what the mind fills in is going to be more horrific than what I or you can write.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Well, certainly than what I or you could write, so. Compared to someone like Smith.
yeah, exactly.
Speaking of which, I love this way he puts this as well. So we've got Maspierre, who's staring aghast at his friend, who's being torn apart and rendered by this monstrosity. Maspierre was unable to describe the creature with minuteness, for he had seen it but dimly and partially in the unlit street. Or moreover, the fate of his companion, who had fallen to the cobblestones with the black devil snarling and tearing at his throat, had not induced Maspierre to linger in that vicinity. Not induced him to linger.
He had betaken himself from the scene with all the celerity of which he was capable. I bet he did. Gave it leg.
run away.
run away.
Yeah. So he goes straight to the house of the priest, and it sounds like they get this this sort of little posse together very quickly. And we've got the priest in front with the holy water and the aspergillus that we mentioned. And, of course, we've got your good old Universal film mob carrying torches and staves and halberds. Always like a good halberd.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Maspierre's story is soon confirmed because they find the body of Mazal with fearfully mangled face, throat and bosom lined with bloody lacerations. No sign of the monstrous assailant.
We have a lovely, another lovely term to start off the next paragraph. Consternation was rife on the morrow. Again, I bet it was. Yeah.
It's always a nice understatement with Smith.
I love it. I absolutely love it.
Yeah. When it comes to that emotional stuff, you know, it's always nicely understated.
Yeah, I really like it because, I mean, you get it in a lot of, when you read other authors, to be like, oh, pandemonium the following morning.
Yeah.
You know, you don't really need to spell it out that much, I don't think, but I really like the understated nature of it. I think it's really nice.
Well, I think as well, if you establish that if everything is at level 9 or 10, then when you come to your big scene with the whatever it is, you can't go up, can you?
That's a very good point, yeah.
Whereas if everything... We're not saying that people were calm,
no,
but they were concerned. So you're at about a 6 or a 7, you know. We've got a few notches to go before we reach that hysteria full horror point.
Yeah, it's like your DEFCON system, isn't it? You know,
Def consternation.
Yeah, so this would be like Def Con 3, you know, and then ramping up to Def Con 1 at the end.
You know? Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot of sprinkling of holy water and the mumbling of stated forms. And this is Smith and religion again, right? Because it never seems that enamoured of it.
No.
And as is usually the case in these stories, that's all futile. For the evil spirit was still abroad, and its malignity was proven once more on the following night. Two victims this time, burgers.
One chicken, one turkey.
Yeah. It's Razor Burger, Ben.
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
and we get it seems quite keen on, or something he mentions on all of these victims is their respectability. You know, here we've got two burgers of high probity and some consequence. So you wonder if these are random attacks, or is this thing targeting the good and the best of the population?
Now, I got that. I instantly thought these are targeted attacks. And these are the people who have obviously scorned it, you know, they've scorned him in the past. These are the people who've made his life hell, because they're the sort of the great and good. They're the people who look down on him and say he's a wrong'un and all that kind of business. Because as we'll see, the other gargoyle is definitely targeted.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So it's actively searching, isn't it, for a particular person?
Yeah, I kind of see this as this gargoyle. He's almost like he's got a hit list. That's how I saw it. But whether I'm right or not is up to speculation, but that's how I kind of had it in my head.
So, yeah, and it gets both of these people this time. They're gone instantly. It seems like it just drops down on them in an alleyway, tears them to pieces, and the local people hear the shrill cries of the helpless men and the guttural growling of the demon. And people don't dare come out, but they peer out of the window and see this thing blotting out the autumn stars with the sable and misshapen foulness of its wings and hovering inexorable menace above the housetops. So you got the great image of almost this thing silhouetted against the stars.
Yeah, it's like the classic Batman thing, isn't it? You know, the bat against the moon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I actually experienced last year when I was in the New Forest.
All right.
We're walking back to where we were staying, and it was dark by this point and the moon was up. And there was a bunch of bats flew past, and one of them actually did it.
Oh, nice.
But I didn't get my camera out in time.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Was that a little nod from your spirit animal, do you think, perhaps?
I think it must have been, yeah. It's like, oh, there's a goth, I'll go and put a show on for him.
That was like, all right, All right, mate.
Yeah.
All right.
All right, mate. Yeah, yeah.
Nice. So, of course, people are loath to go out at night and venture abroad, unless in case of dire and exigent need. And those who did go out, well, they form up in their little groups again, all with their flambeaux and their halberds and holy water and all the rest of it, one imagines, because they think that's going to frighten the thing away. The light from their torches is going to frighten this creature off.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nope.
Nope, nope, because the boldness of this fiend was beyond measure, for it proceeded to attack more than one company of worthy citizens, disregarding the flaring torches that were thrust in its face or putting them out with the stenchful wind of its wide vans.
Mm, and you may remember vans we mentioned last time, wasn't it? Is that in the last story, those big bat wings?
Indeed.
And you get a sense of the sheer hatred of this thing, because it just shreds people to bits.
Yeah.
This isn't, it's not predatory in the sense that it's carrying them off to feast on them.
It's not feeding. It's just
vicious. Yeah. Just absolutely vicious. Yeah. And there was one name here that I couldn't find anything about. So everyone agrees that it's got the head of a ferocious animal, the wings of a monstrous bird. Some, the most learned in demonology, which must have been a tricky subject to study at that time, to be careful doing that, were fain to identify it with Modo, the spirit of murder.
Mm.
Now, that's something that's not familiar to me at all, and I've not been able to find anything about that. So, again, if any listeners out there know who Modo, the spirit of murder, is, I'd be interested to hear.
There's a bloody sushi restaurant down here in Brighton.
Oh, is it? Well, I don't know. That's a good recommendation to go
to. Fish murder, maybe. Yeah.
You don't want to have one of those. Is it some sort of blowfish, isn't it, that has to be prepared just right?
Oh, yeah. Tetradoxin, isn't it? The pufferfish venom. Yeah.
But again, we continue with this theme about the devil and everything, because others say this could be one of the great lieutenants of Satan, perhaps Amaon or Alastor, gone mad with exasperation at the impregnable supremacy of Christ in the holy city of Ville. So it's an interesting idea that the city is made, or the town is made safe, because they've got the nunnery and the monastery and the big cathedral, yet at the same time building those, particularly the cathedral, has somehow spurred this creature to appear.
Mm. Yeah, that's an interesting thought.
And that seems to spur the people on, in some cases, to reject Christianity, because quite soon here we get a wave of murder and rape and black masses going on and all this kind of thing.
It's that hysteria thing, isn't it? It's, you know, you get that when you get any sort of upheaval, you know. I mean, you saw it after, like, the 9/11 attacks and things like that, didn't you? There was, you know, retaliations and all this kind of stuff going on.
Oh, there were Sikhs being attacked in America and stuff like that. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, and to the same sort of degree, but different. You had the same thing with the pandemic, didn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, how many people lost their mind on the internet because they were stuck inside?
yeah. Well, not just that, but then the other stuff. I actually blocked someone today for some stuff that they put up. Well, that's going off subject, but, you know.
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. Really? Really? Okay.
I know. All right. It's ridiculous, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. Now, we've not had a band name for a little while, but we've got one here.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a good one. So we get this idea that this terror takes hold of the population, and it sort of reveals this clotted, seething, devil-ridden gloom of superstitious obsession, not to be hinted in modern language. So it's interesting that underneath that veneer of the respectable, there's still this seething mass of superstition and fear and terror. Mm. And here we go. Even by daylight, the gothic wings of nightmare seem to brood in underparting oppression above the city. The gothic wings of nightmare. There you go.
Nice. Nice, yeah. I like the superstitious obsession, I like as well.
yeah.
That could be the album.
That could be the album, couldn't it?
Yeah.
And the old Bish is not proving too effective, is he? Ambrosius?
No, he's not.
In fact, they send someone to Rome to get water specially sanctified by the Pope.
And it was probably about as effective as you'd think.
And then things ramp up even further. I like this in stories where you think, oh, that's bad, isn't it? Oh, it just got worse. Surely it can't get any worse than this. Oh, it just did.
Yeah.
Because we have two things now. One is the abbot of the local monastery gets seized. And he was on his way to do something nice. He was going to administer extreme unction to a dying friend. So he was on a mission of mercy. And he's seized just before he reaches the threshold of his destination and torn apart.
Mm.
But then it gets really bad. On the very next night, while the torn body of the abbot lay on a rich catafalque in the cathedral, and masses were being said and tapers burnt, the demon invaded the high nave through the open door, extinguished all the candles with one flap of its sooty wings, and dragged down no less than three of the officiating priests to an unholy death in the darkness. I love that imagery of it putting the candles out with a flap of the wing.
Yeah. I mean, that's a classic from horror movies, isn't it?
Mm.
You get that. Sometimes it's a spectral wind that blows them out, or sometimes, yeah, it's the wings of some great behemoth flying in. I think there was a scene in one of the early, it may have been the first series of The Witcher. I seem to remember a scene like that. I seem to remember it. Oh, that's a classic, because the way it was done, it was like the beating of the wings taking out the things. Yeah.
That had some moments in it, didn't it?
It did.
That series.
It did.
The opening episode, I think there was the very opening scene where he fights that big spider thing. And then was it in the first episode? There was that really great sword fight.
Yeah,
in the town. That's one of the best I've ever seen filmed.
But, yeah, the first series was definitely the highlight, the high point of that for me. It's kind of it's been on a steady decline right from the start for me.
Yeah, and I could see this sort of story being filmed in that fashion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could see a treatment of that working in that style.
Well, even better, like the video games, this would be a great quest line in one of those. Like Elder Scrolls or something, right? This would be a great quest line. You know, you just get to this new city, there's gargoyles about, you've got to go and sort them out kind of thing.
I mean, yeah, this is like, well, when we get on to the Colossus of Elorn, we can talk about the RPG versions, certainly, because some of these have been converted to RPG scenarios.
Indeed.
So not only does it get worse because of this outrage, this blasphemy, it gets worse because now a second creature is spotted as well. Mm. This is Smith again, isn't it? A second devil had been seen in Vion. The murderous fiend was accompanied by a spirit of equal deformity and darkness, whose intentions were those of lechery and which molested none but women.
This creature had frightened several dames and damoiselles and maidservants into a veritable hysteria by peering through their bedroom windows, and had sidled lasciviously with uncouth mouths and grimaces and grotesque flappings of its bat-shaped wings towards others who had occasion to fare from house to house across the nocturnal streets. So basically it's a peeping Tom gargoyle.
Yeah, yeah, and it says that it's making improper suggestions.
Yeah. I think every town has had the stories about the pervert who was peering through people's windows. You know, I don't know if you get them anymore, but you used to get, you know, you get all the old grannies talking about them, wouldn't they?
Yeah. It did used to be a thing. And I think the last time I can remember something like that was the clown scares of...
Well, that indeed, must have been
about 10 years ago, something like that.
Yeah, the creepy clown thing, yeah.
Yeah, I even had a friend whose wife refused to go out because of the clowns. I mean, it's quite frightening, really. The not the thing itself, but the way that fear spreads without any real event. Nothing. I mean, at least here you've got a couple of things flying around that, you know,
indeed,
I'd stay indoors, you know.
Oh, absolutely. The clown thing made me, I can't help laughing when I think about that, because one of these idiots dressing up as a clown thought it'd be a great idea to do that in Moss Side in Manchester.
Oh, my word. Did he survive the experience?
He did, but he had to get out of there pretty damn quick.
Yeah, I think one clip on social media somewhere of one of those trying that and just getting, you know.
Oh God, if you can't death wish. Yeah.
But that still goes on with your pranks thing, right? It's
I know.
People go up to a gang member and say something insulting and then get surprised when they get slapped. Oh, it's just a prank.
Yeah, well,
I don't know.
It's like that episode of Black Books where he's trying to get out of doing his taxes, so he goes up to a pair of Millwall supporters and starts insulting them.
Yes. So, but then we get that thing we mentioned earlier of this lustful creature isn't actually physically attacking anyone, and it seems more as though it's searching for a specific person. And here we go again. Many were approached by it and were terrified immoderately by the hideous and lustfulness of its demeanour. So we can only guess what that refers
to. Indeed. Full body, right?
Full body, yes, the old spout. If you weren't going to say it,
brilliant.
And even in that time of horror, both spiritual and corporeal, there were those who made a ribald jest of this singular abstention on the part of the demon. So that's so typical as well, isn't it?
Isn't it just?
You know, it used to be the case when someone passed away the next day. Oh, did you hear about da 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 da? There was always the sick joke, wasn't there?
Oh, absolutely. Going
straight out.
Yeah. Oh, God, I remember. I think the news was still on the TV when I started getting the jokes about Princess Diana, you know, and all that.
Yeah,
all my work colleagues, you know, because I'd just got a mobile phone, one of them Nokia.
The old green screen and all that stuff.
Yeah. And it was just like, fucking hell, guys.
Yeah, some people have no respect. All right, that takes us into chapter 3. And now we switch over to the POV of Blaise Renard. So now we get his take on what's going on. Because so far we can speculate he obviously created these. He's the maker of gargoyles. So is this all part of some diabolic plan? And it came as a surprise. I mean, I've read this before, but I remember first reading it. It's in some way, it's nothing really to do with him, is it? It's certainly not an intention on his part.
No.
He's not carried out some ritual to give these things life.
No, because I was expecting that, like, again, but the first time I read it, because of, you know, the references to how he looked and that he looked like a necromancer, I was like, all right, well, we know where this is going. So when it cuts to this next chapter, and he's basically on the piss because he lives across from the tavern, where obviously this Nicolette works, you know, it's owned by her father. So he's in there getting soused every night, isn't he? And he doesn't know what's going on at all. So that came as a real surprise.
Yeah. He's basically sat there staring at her with hot and sullen eyes and gulping joylessly the potent vintages of Aberoin. And the people in there, they don't really like him. They're a bit afraid of him, but he's got a heavy bag of coin at his side. So, you know, they'll tolerate him.
See, again, I've worked in pubs since leaving school. Right? There's always bloody one. Always one. It comes in once a week. You on like a Friday afternoon or something, sits in the corner and just ogles the barmaids all afternoon. Oh. You know, there's always one dirty old lech that comes in, right? So that's how I see this chap. Yeah.
His money is as good as everyone else's.
That's the one. Landlord. Yeah.
I have to say, thankfully, things have changed in that respect. Well, I know exactly what you mean with that. Yeah. So he sat there staring at Nicolette, and this makes it very clear that he's got no sort of active part in this. Like everyone else in Vion, Reynard had felt the suffocating burden of superstitious terror during those nights when the fiendish marauder was hovering above the town and might descend on the luckless wayfarer at any moment. Nothing less urgent and imperative than the obsession of his half-bestial longing for Nicolette could have induced him to traverse after dark the length of the winding alley to the tavern door. So even though he's literally just got to go down the alley to get into the tavern, if it wasn't for this passion, this lust, he'd be too scared to do it.
Yeah.
So he's totally oblivious to the fact that these are his gargoyles. There's no direction or control coming from him.
Yeah, definitely.
And we get this nice description of him actually walking down the alleyway, and Smith once again just sets the scene. so well here. So he talks about the previous nights have been moonless, but now we've got the newborn crescent was lowering its fragile sanguine-coloured horn beyond the housetops as Reynard went forth from his lodgings. And we get that feeling of the gloom was curded by the unclean umbrage of satanic wings and might reveal in another instant the gleaming of abhorrent eyes ignited by the everlasting coals of the pit.
Yeah. See, that's the thing as well. You know how the mind plays tricks in the dark, right? We've talked about this before, that primal fear of the dark, right? You're walking down a dark alley.
Yeah.
You do start imagining eyes in the corners and, you know, especially, you know, you're in like the back streets of London or something. There could be anybody lurking there, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're around old places or places you're not familiar with. There's some places with that sort of atmosphere, isn't there?
Oh, God, yeah.
And in fact, he does get this. He thinks he gets a glimpse of, is it a cloud?
Mm.
It has a semblance of uncouthly arched and pointed wings, but it's probably just his imagination, right?
Yeah, yeah. But still, you know, he can't shake it off, so he quickens his pace, doesn't he, and gets inside the tavern pretty damn quick.
And now we get into the tavern scene. This is why I feel, again, we'll talk about RPGs and Dungeons & Dragons in particular. This kind of scene is so D&D to me. Yeah. We've got the description of the people in the tavern, and Nicolette is obviously there working for her father. She's serving wine to a mercer's assistant, one Raoul Coupain, a personable youth and a newcomer in the neighbourhood. Oh, and they're having a right old laugh, aren't they?
Yes.
Bit of a flirt and a laugh going on. And Reynard's not too happy about this.
Yeah, and as always, the tavern owner, Jean, Nicolette's father, is discussing in a low voice the latest enormities of the demons with the two cronies at a table in the farthest corner, and was drinking fully as much liquor as his customers. Typical landlord.
Drinking from his own tap.
Well, you got to make sure the beer's not gone off, haven't you?
Oh, yes. Got to check it.
Absolutely. The whole chef thing. You've got to try the wine. If it's not good enough to drink, don't cook with it. There you go.
And Reynard gets sort of ignored. He sits at the table. No one even looks at him. No one, Nicolette doesn't come over to serve him or anything else. So he starts to bang on the table with his heavy fists. I like this. Again, Smith doesn't have to put this stuff in, but I just feel it builds the characters a little. It's a very small thing. Villon, so that's the tavern owner, who had been sitting all the while with his back turned, now called out to Nicolette without even troubling to face around on his stool, telling her to serve Reynard. It's just, get him a drink, will you? can't even be asked to turn around.
It's so well observed, isn't it? Because that is exactly what would happen, That was exactly, because he's not working, is he? He's sitting drinking with his mates. So it's like,
It's far too busy. She brings his drink over, kind of slams it on the tabletop and goes and walks off, tossing her head lightly and scornfully. With more glances at Coupain, the girl obeyed. She placed the fiery, blood-dark wine before Reynard without speaking, and then went back to resume her bantering with the mercer's assistant. I couldn't remember what a mercer was. Were they something to do with cloth?
Dealer in textile fabrics, especially silks, velvets, and other fine materials.
Ah, right. So you can imagine he's quite well-dressed, this guy, then.
Yeah.
Probably cuts a dash, the latest fashion.
Indeed. He does that thing, doesn't he, now? He's sitting there and he's getting wound up and he's drinking. And he's getting more wound up, so he's drinking more. And it's one of them situations. You've been in pubs, I've been in pubs. You can always tell when someone's going to start going off, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
You can sense it,
Especially in this kind of situation as well, right?
Yeah.
Because flirting develops and now he's, he kisses her hand and she goes, oh, it's all that sort of set up. And
then she sits next to him on the bench. Yeah. And it's like, oh, here we go.
So Reynard is up. He's up on his feet and he's rushing forwards and he's going to just tear this guy apart with his bare hands, which is a kind of reflection of that homicidal rage of the gargoyle, right?
Indeed.
But of course, old Villon, the tavern keeper, although he's lurching a little from his potations, stands up and gets in the way, and it's one of those sit down, son, you've had enough to drink kind of jobs.
Yeah, exactly. Especially he pulls a knife, doesn't he? Oh no, it's Coupon, isn't it? Yeah, it's Coupon.
They pick up on Reynard's sheer hatred here. They can see he longs to kill Villon and Coupon, to kill the hateful cronies who sat staring from the corner, and then above their throttled corpses to ravage with fierce kisses and vehement caresses the shrinking lips and body of Nicolette. So, you know, is the wine has totally unleashed his passions, if you like, his murderous intent and his darker lust as well.
It's interesting because this is kind of like, you know, they talk, you always hear that thing about the two wolves that live inside you.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, this guy's got two gargoyles living inside him.
Oh, nice.
That's, you know.
Yeah, very nice. Yeah. And in a way, one assists the other, because if all of his rivals are killed and destroyed, then in his mind, she's going to choose him, right?
Mm.
You know, the actuality of it is that she's not going to choose him regardless. But,
indeed.
You know, yeah. But he doesn't see that. So, being unarmed and seeing himself outnumbered, Reynard paused again, though his anger still simmered within, like the contents of a sorcerer's cauldron. And this is where he notices something outside the leaded panes of the tavern window. A vague shape or figure is outside the window, but not for long, because it comes crashing in. This is a pure action scene now, isn't it?
Yeah, I love this. The litter of falling glass, you've got all the candles are being blown out and the shadows are dancing. And yeah, it's a great scene.
This thing hovers. I like that as well. It doesn't come crashing in and charge at someone. It hovers up by the ceiling. Mm. They saw the malignant burning of its eyes like coals in the depths of Tartarian pits and the curling of its hateful lips. And behind it, another shadowy flying monster came in through the broken window with a loud flapping of its ribbed and pointed wings. There was something lascivious in the very motion of its flight. Lascivious flight. I like to see that.
I like the fact that its wings are ribbed. You know, in my brain.
Ribbed, yeah, yeah. I caught that as well.
Ribbed, for her pleasure.
Unless you wear them inside out. Anyway. Yeah, its satyr-like face was twisted in a horrible, never-changing leer, and its lustful eyes were fixed on Nicolette as it hung in the air beside the first intruder. I like this hanging in the air, hovering thing.
Mm.
That gives it added weirdness, I think, or horror.
Yeah. Well, you can imagine like the noise of the rhythmic beat of the wings as it's hanging there to keep stationary.
Yeah.
Be like whomp, whomp, sort of thing, you know. Yeah.
This is another Harryhausen scene, isn't it? You could picture this. It is. Like Jason and the Argonauts. Was that the Harpies where that guy is attacked?
Yeah.
The blind guy, wasn't it, I think?
Yeah.
Yeah, very reminiscent of that. So you get this. Again, every good action scene has this moment, this little pause, the calm before the storm, and then it all kicks off.
It's where in a Western you'd get the Ennio Morricone bit, you know.
The little...
yeah.
Or the music box. Ding, ding.
Oh, yeah, that's the...
Winding down. Yeah. That's a great scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nicolette screams and turns to flee. Jean Villon, her father, throat torn open. Gurgling blood choke groan. Rail Coupain, same thing. They're both gone in a second. In the meanwhile, the other had pursued and overtaken the fleeing girl and had seized her in its bestial forearms, with the ribbed wings enfolding her like a hellish drapery. And that hellish drapery, wouldn't that be a sort of goth soft furnishing store?
Indeed.
Welcome to a hellish drapery.
Another good band name, Hellish Drapery. Well, that for me, that sort of brought to mind, you know, your classic vampire.
Oh, yeah.
Surrounding a woman with its cape, you know, that kind of thing.
Reynard heard the guttural snarling of the murderous monster, muffled by the body of Coupain, whom it was tearing with its teeth. And he heard the lubricious laughter of the incubus above the shrieks of the hysterically frightened girl. Then we get all our tapers, all the candles are blown out again. And Reynard received a violent blow. So it seems like one of these wings just buffets him and is knocked to the floor unconscious. So not only does he not have any control over these things, they totally disregard him as well, because he's not killed, right? This is almost by accident. He gets knocked out.
Right. Just again, it's a testament to how my brain works here. That when you mentioned lubricious laughter of the incubus, I was hearing Sid James.
Yes, indeed. So that takes us into chapter 4. Reynard wakes up, surrounded by the thronging of many faces. So obviously all this consternation has brought the mob out again, and we've got a crowd of people with torches and knives and halberds. We've got the corpses of Villon and Coupain. We've got Nicolette with her green gown in shreds, her body crushed by the embraces of the demon, but she's still alive. She's moaning feebly while women crowd around about her to help. And the two cronies of Villon, horribly clawed and mangled, were dead beside their overturned table. So naturally, there's a little bit of suspicion falls on Reynard, because he's the only one still alive in a room full of, well, the only man still alive in a room full of corpses. But it's obvious that he couldn't have done all this himself. And, you know, if it had just been this incident, then maybe, but people have seen these things. But he won't tell them what he saw, because he knows now what they are.
Yeah, and he sort of gets up, doesn't he, and sort of, he knows, and so he sort of pushes out, doesn't he? He's one of those, I've got to get out of here kind of thing. And he wanders around through the streets for many hours, and some while in his wanderings he came to his own workshop. With no assignable reason for the act, he entered and re-emerged with a heavy hammer, which he carried with him during his subsequent peregrinations. Then, driven by his awful and unremissive torture, he went on till the pale dawn had touched the spires and the housetops with a ghostly glimmering. There's another band name.
Ghostly glimmering, yeah. So he's not working under any plan here, is he? It's almost like he's like an automaton. He just wanders to his workshop, gets a hammer. Then it's like he's just walking in a daze around the streets, and he just happens to come into the square with the cathedral, where the cathedral is.
And that's where the penny drops, isn't it? You know, it's like...
Yeah. And I did notice, just talking about Smith's language, at one point the cathedral is mentioned as erection. Just that.
Yes.
Had to say that as well. It's probably got a very big tower, isn't it?
Like your purple dome tower and the Tower of the Toad and the Nookinomicon.
Yes, has to be done. Yes, and it's that very tower on which his own gargoyles were ensconced. In the chill and livid light of sunless morning, he emerged on the roof, and leaning perilously from the verge, he examined the carven figures. And of course, he sees that the teeth and claws of the cat-headed griffin were stained with blood, and shreds of apple-green cloth were hanging from the talons of the lustful bat-winged satyr. So, confirmation that it is his gargoyles coming to life.
To be fair, even though he is a kind of, he's a despicable kind of chap, but he tries to do the right thing here, which I thought was quite an interesting turn of events.
It does, and this sort of surprised me a little bit as well, because you might think, I've got my revenge on these people, or can I learn to control these things?
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. He does make the right choice.
Yeah.
And he's gonna smash them up, basically. Or he's gonna try and smash them up.
Yeah. Yeah, so he climbs up there, doesn't he? He's teetering on the edge and starts whacking away. But he merely chipped the features of the gargoyle and had not wiped away the malignant lust and exultation. So again, he raised the heavy hammer.
Yeah, so he starts on the satyr, and like you say, he's right on the edge of the ledge here. Mm. And he raises the hammer again when something grabs him.
I thought that was great. Come here, you.
And again, it's very clear now that he has no control over these creatures at all. But then I guess he has no control over his own passions and hatred and all the rest of it. So
no,
perhaps that's appropriate, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's basically a metaphor, isn't it? They're a metaphor for his sort of abhorrent drives, if you will.
Yeah. And yes, he's grabbed. Sharp pain in the shoulder, and he looks around, and the cat-headed gargoyle has sunk its talons into his shoulder and is pulling him back. And you get one of these nice again, very filmic, struggles in a higher place. You know, they're struggling backwards and forwards. You've got the leering face of this thing with the fangs getting closer and closer. You could almost imagine it. Wasn't there the scene in Alien where the jaws slowly come in towards someone's face?
Yes.
I'm sure it's in loads of films, and drool comes out and drips on the person and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's in the first Alien movie. I think it's Brett, isn't it? The guy with the cat, the engineer chap. I think it's him when he goes, he's down in the cargo bay and it comes out really slowly and he is just saliva all over his face.
So, yeah, he has an instinctive impulse to defend himself, so he hits out at the gargoyle, whose cruel features seem to approach him like something seen in the ultimate madness and distortion of delirium. So he hits out, but he misses the face, and he hits the foreleg, whose curving talons were fixed in his shoulder like meat hooks. That's quite a nice phrase.
That is a nice touch, yeah.
There's a sharp crack. The leaning gargoyle vanishes, but then is off. He's overbalanced. He's off the edge. He's falling.
You get another one of those great descriptions that Smith does. The vertiginous turning movement is something he uses for travel a lot, isn't it? Through the gulfs of eternity or space or whatever. But this time it's a much more mundane travel.
quite shorter as well.
Short trip with a bad landing.
150 foot, yeah. It's not the fall that kills you, it's the sudden stop at the end.
That's the one.
Yeah. And I like the way how it's not so much that he's falling, it's more that the dark mass of the cathedral tower soars away from him and rushes upwards. That's a nice perspective.
It is.
Well, not nice, but... You know.
Yeah, I don't think I'd like to experience it, but it's a great image. Yeah. It's something else you see in film, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And appropriately enough, it's the Archbishop Ambrosius on his way to early mass who found the shattered body of Reynard lying face downward in the square. Ambrosius crossed himself in startled horror at the sight, and then, when he saw the object that was still clinging to Reynard's shoulder, he repeated the gesture with a more than pious promptness. So, of course, that stone foreleg, its claws are buried deep into Reynard's shoulder still.
Mm.
But the Archbishop sees something more than that as well. I think it's because he's an art lover, it's described how he remembers things, right? If you see a sculpture or a painting, you have a very vivid image of it in your mind. And in the case of the gargoyle, that foreleg was in a very particular pose, and now it's in another pose.
Yeah, I thought that's a really nice touch. It's a great little story, that. It's certainly one of the more action-packed of Smith's. There's a lot more action in that than some other of his stories. But I really enjoyed that. I liked it the first time I read it, and I think I enjoyed it even more this time around because I'm more familiar with Averroine. I think reading these in order has given me a real, like, an enhanced appreciation of the Averroine stories.
And it's interesting how we get this range of things as well, and of course, as we'll see as we go on. So, yeah, there's going to be a werewolf. We've got, I suppose, the Pan character is a bit of a repeating thing now. But we've got a cat-faced, bird-winged, griffin-like gargoyle. You know, we've got enchantresses. We've got druids. There's a whole mix of things in this forest. It's a very fertile ground for supernatural creatures, it seems.
Oh, yeah. And all the meanwhile, you've got the old cult of the toad god in there as well. Under the Sadaquai is how you
identify. Sadaquai. Yeah, which again underpins, I mean, this one was overtly Christian in its point of view.
Yeah.
Which the last one was, but as we said, with that underlying mythos, there's not a hint of mythos in this one. You could read this just as a straight horror story.
Indeed.
So you wouldn't necessarily class this as a mythos tale, even though Averroine, I feel, is part of the mythos.
Oh, I think so. But I think that's because of the perspective of the people. Whereas in the last one, you had obviously the sorceress who knows of the mythos, you know, the Book of Ibon and all that kind of business. So you've got her knowledge of this. Whereas these are very pious Christian folk. There's an archbishop. They're not going to know of this. So to them, it's just going to be anything that happens that's preternatural or supernatural, or however you want to term it, they're going to put it down to the devil or the great adversary, as they say. Whereas maybe other people who know more might say, actually, I think you're fine. That's something to do with Yogg-Sothoth.
Which leads us into that speculation again, because where does the life force for these gargoyles come from? We've got that idea of a sort of a emotional transference, or the idea of, again, we talked about, well, genius loci, right? If you go to certain places, there's an atmosphere, which some speculate a very emotional event went on there, and that becomes imprinted or somehow sinks into the very fabric, the physical fabric of the place.
Yeah.
So is that this, that intense emotion that he feels, the hatred and the lust and everything else, is somehow that the gargoyles are imbued with that in some strange process?
Yeah, I think that's how I saw it, really. It's, yeah, like you say, like genius loci, or, you know, what they call a residual haunting or something like that.
Yeah.
It's like, you can imagine while he was working on the rageful one, he was really cheesed off with away, people, yeah. Really hammering it away and going, you know, bastards, I'll show them, sort of thing. And maybe he'd been at the pub in the afternoon when he went back and started working on the other one, and he's all a bit hot under the collar, so to speak. So, yeah, one can only speculate.
Well, yeah, because there's no, you know, it's not like a ritual. It's not like he's poured blood on them or made some sort of abeyance to Sartogu or even the devil or anything, right?
No.
He's totally oblivious to this. It's that's an interesting mechanic, and I can't think it's one that I've ever seen. Normally, he would be the, you know, the necromancer or the evil sorcerer, wouldn't he? But it is almost, I don't want to say he's innocent in this, because like you say, he's not certainly not a pleasant character, but in a sense, he is innocent.
Yeah, it wasn't intentional, was it?
Yeah, I mean, what would you get? What would this be, sort of manslaughter, diminished responsibility? I'm not really sure if you could even prove that in court, could you?
I don't know. No. Yeah. That's an interesting thought. Yeah.
This is going to be a future thing, right, as we get into AI and androids and all that stuff. So if you created and built an android and it went out and killed someone, where does that leave you?
Well, Terminator 2. It's Dyson, isn't it?
Right.
Sarah Connor goes to Dyson's to kill him before he creates Skynet, because in his mind, Dyson is a war criminal.
Right.
But all that was the chap that had made the software, sort of thing.
Is that, you know? Is that why he switched to making Hoovers instead?
Yeah. I discovered earlier earlier this month what sent Skynet homicidal.
Oh, go on.
Yeah. Well, if you go on YouTube now, you keep getting these adverts for female AI chat bots.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So what it was lots of teenagers sending Skynet dick pics. That's what sent it homicidal. In my opinion, that's it. That's it. Case closed.
Perhaps it just said, you obviously, as a species, you don't deserve to exist anymore.
Exactly.
My word.
On that note.
So, yeah, in a sense, then, are these gargoyles sort of medieval androids? You know, I'm not saying in technological terms, but to all intents and purposes, they're beings created to carry out some task. Although, we're subconsciously, there's a subconscious thing going on there, transference, perhaps.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, there's a lot more going on than you'd think just on the surface with this story.
That's typical Smith, though, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's always, the monster comes to life and it kills someone and then they burn the tower down.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but the wizard escaped by going through a door to Saturn. And now he's having rumpy with a 15-legged, 15-foot-tall alien
thing. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right, well, I believe you've got another letter for us on the subject of the maker of gargoyles.
Yeah, and there's just the briefest mention of it, but there's also a nice mention here of August Derleth, because, as you told us at the start, Derleth had quite a big hand in giving some ideas for this story and some input. And again, the address for this one is well, probably longer than the comment, certainly harder to pronounce. So I'm just going to have a quick vocal limber up.
Here we go.
And this is HPL to Clark Ashton, 11th of September, 1931. Crypt of Hapuhu Ir Echa on the extra cosmic comet Thun. Hour of approach to the black sun, Gnorchthun, in the seventh dimension beyond the uttermost rim.
Bravo. Bravo, sir.
I need a rest after that.
God.
And HPL writes, that new ending of the Gargoyles sounds pretty good to me. Indeed, little Derleth is getting cleverer and cleverer in his weird ideas. Some of his new tales are really remarkably good, especially such specimens as The Thing That Walked Upon the Wind, The House with the Magnolias, and They Shall Rise in Great Numbers. Be on the lookout also for a very effective new story of Belknaps, the Brain Eaters. A ship sails into an alien dimension, the amorphous marine inhabitants of which have curious tastes in feeding. Great stuff. So I always think that praise from HBO is high praise indeed, because he was never backward in criticism, was he?
No, I've got to say that The Thing That Walked on the Wind is one of my favourite August Derleth stories. It's one of his Ithaca stories.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's a really good one, that.
We must cover that on the IBC then at some time. Yeah. Add to the extremely lengthening and growing lists.
Yeah.
Oh, and can I just mention here, by the way, that just this last week, our episode of the Innsmouth Book Club is dedicated to the memory of Brian Lumley, who sadly passed away a couple of weeks back now. And we do a sort of overview of his work, and we went through one of the Titus Crowe stories.
Yes, De Marigny's Clock.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, before we end the episode, I've been delving through the subsequent issues of Weird Tales, looking for any reader feedback. I got this one from the issue directly afterwards. He's not read the story at this point, but this gives you some kind of indication of how esteemed Smith was in the eyes of the readers at this point, which is why it always surprises me that Farnsworth Wright doesn't seem to get this, right? It's from a guy called Fred C. Miles of New Providence, New Jersey. Ah, what's this? A story by Clark Ashton Smith, the maker of Gargoyles? Boy, that sounds interesting. Ah, well, what has Mr. Smith written that isn't interesting? He undoubtedly, well, in my opinion anyway, is your best author. Seabury Quinn is excellent, but Smith is super excellent. So there you go.
Wow.
Yeah. I like to think that he read these and maybe thought, oh, you know what?
Yeah, you hope so, didn't you? Because as we said before, the thing is with a lot of these authors is they weren't around for long enough to see the impact they had. I mean, although Smith obviously did live up into the 1960s, but I still felt he was underappreciated at that time.
Yeah, I think he was during his lifetime, yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
It's a real shame. And I hope Smith read these letters, because they must have, you know, give him well, somebody likes it anyway, because this is from the next issue, and this is J.D. Arden of Detroit wrote in saying that Clark Ashton Smith's excellent story, The Maker of Gargoyles, is another wonderful tale. Smith has rapidly taken his place among the foremost writers of weird tales. Yes, yeah, so that's a nice thing. Now, I noticed something else, which is really interesting. In the same issue, just below that comment, was a letter from Clark Ashton Smith. Now, there'd been a debate raging because Farnsworth Wright had made the decision to serialize Frankenstein. He'd reprinting Mary Shelley's Frankenstein in serial form. Now, as you can imagine, some people weren't happy about this. It was just like, well, why are you filling up precious column inches with reprints of something that we've all read?
I mean, you know, at that time, Frankenstein's like 100 years old, isn't it, really?
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah, probably didn't have to pay for it, did he?
Of course.
There you go. But, Clark Ashton Smith decided to weigh in on this. Clark Ashton Smith writes, apropos of the reprint question, I'd like to cast my vote against stories of serial length, particularly those that are well known to lovers of the weird. I'd like to see more stories from earlier issues of Weird Tales, as well as other rare items that are difficult to procure. The reprinting of excellent out-of-the-way tales would be a signal service to readers.
That's interesting.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Because I think we have to bear in mind that back then, let's say you started getting into Weird Tales at issue 30 or something.
Yep.
You probably had very little scope for getting any back issues. I can't imagine Wright would have had huge stocks of back issues sitting around.
Well, they were called pulps for a reason. the unsold copies got pulped.
they're here and they're gone. Yeah. And of course, there's no other means that, you know. So that's almost like a best of Weird Tales.
Yeah.
You know, let's do a best of the first 10 issues kind of, which today would be quite a common sort of practice.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
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 So it's, yeah.
Well, that was an interesting point. I just, you know, I like the fact that these guys did used to write in to the magazine, because there was no chat rooms back then. There was no internet. There was no Facebook Messenger, you know, or Twitter or any of this other crap that people use these days to keep to talk to their readers, you know. So that was the way they did it, you know.
That's very true, though. Yeah. Having said that, I find when you look around, I mean, we can think of the lovely Ramsey Campbell, who's very active on some parts of social media and so funny and entertaining, some of his posts, and always seems very open about answering questions or getting involved in discussions, and other people you can't even get in contact with.
Indeed.
Yeah. You know? And I'm not saying that as a criticism, no. Because I understand that, you know. So even though everyone in theory has got access to everyone else now, it doesn't necessarily follow that everyone wants that, you know.
Yeah.
Well, there we are. I think we're really getting into our stride with this volume, and we've got some great stories coming up. I mean, starting off with two Averoigne stories has been excellent. And next time, it really gets even better, because we're going to be covering Beyond the Singing Flame.
Indeed. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. And then, we got some great ones coming up in this season.
I think the Vaults of Jovombis is after that.
Isn't it? Indeed, it is, yeah.
And I think Beyond the Singing Flame is interesting because it's a rare sequel.
Yes.
It's. I know we've got the Space Adventures.
Captain Douchebag. Yeah.
Captain Douchebag. But they kind of hang together. But, you know, I think as we've said before, they're not top-tier Smith by any means, as enjoyable as they are.
Oh, yeah.
But City of the Singing Flame is often touted as one of his best stories.
Indeed.
So, yes, we're looking forward to that one.
Absolutely.
Great. Well, thanks very much for joining us today, folks. Thanks for listening. I'd just like to give a quick mention to Jurik de Wetter. We did mention last time the name Phlegethon, the burning river in which souls are eternally tormented. And I think we both said, oh, that should be a band name. Well, Jurik got in touch on YouTube to say, of course it is, and gave us a nice link to Phlegethon. We'll put that below. If you're into certain types of metal, I think you'll enjoy it.
Nice.
And it's certainly a great name. Would also like to thank and welcome Barbara Reed as our latest patron, our latest acolyte. If you'd like to join her in supporting the show, please do check out our Patreon site. Remember, you get bonus episodes not only of Strange Shadows, but also the Innsmouth Book Club. And this year, we are planning on putting a lot more bonus content out there.
Yep.
So that's it for us for today. We bid you adieu and au revoir from the forests of Averoigne. Je m'appelle Robert Poynton.
You don't expect me. So, I don't know. And you just said, my name is Rob Poynton. You didn't say goodbye. Oh, we're terrible. We are such numpties at times. And it's goodbye from me, Tim Mendes.